Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books and East European Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Jean Swain, at the University of California, Irvine. Today, we'll be talking with Brigitte Le Normand about her recent book, Designing Tito's Capital, Urban Planning, Modernism, and Socialism in Belgrade, published by University of Pittsburgh Press. So welcome to New Books in East European Studies, Brigitte.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you about this book. I found the architectural history really interesting. And as a more detailed introduction, I wonder if you would tell us a bit about yourself, how you became interested in architectural history, and also how you became interested in Yugoslavia.
Well, I grew up in Montreal, Canada, and I came of age at a time when Quebec was deciding whether it was going to stay in Canada. And so perhaps it's not much of a surprise that when Yugoslavia's breakdown was in the news, that really resonated with me. And really, I think I decided to study Yugoslavia when I was doing my undergraduate, and I simply I was studying Western Europe, and it had lost its novelty. I had even done an exchange in Paris, and somehow it seemed that everyone had already written everything there was to write about the French Revolution. So I was feeling adrift, and I went to see a play about the war in Bosnia. And there was something about that play that really kind of grabbed me from inside. And so, like many of my peers, I became interested in Yugoslavia because of, you know, the spectacular way in which it fell apart. As for the built environment, I actually became interested in that partly through meeting my husband, who is an architect, who introduced me to new ways of looking at the built environment and thinking about the built environment and its connections to society and to philosophy and to all kinds of interesting questions beyond the technical. And it all just kind of came together when I started doing my PhD and was looking for a project to work on. I had begun learning Serbo-Croatian a couple of years before, and it had taken me to Belgrade. And prior to Belgrade, I had started learning the language in Zagreb. And Zagreb was very quaint and pretty, had lovely Austro-Hungarian architecture and squares, and it was really a lovely place. And then I went to Belgrade. And Belgrade was a complete mess. It was right after the end of the Milosevic regime. There was garbage in the streets. None of the infrastructure functioned properly. It was dirty. It was falling apart. It had, you know, none of these charming, you know, Austro-Hungarian buildings, and instead a lot of 20th century falling apart architecture. And yet there was something about Belgrade that I found really fascinating. There was a kind of a vibe about the city, a kind of excitement, a kind of dynamism that I hadn't found as much in Zagreb. And so I decided that I wanted to get a better understanding of the built environment of this capital city of Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your book does tie all of those aspects in, the economic and ideological and social questions that can be revealed through the built environment. So I look forward to talking about that with you as we go through the book. But before, your book is really looking at the post-war reconstruction of Belgrade. So just to kind of get us started here, can you describe what Belgrade looked like before World War II and what it looked like at the end of the war?
So Belgrade had really started to grow as an urban center in the late 19th century, partly as a result of Serbia achieving statehood, and as a result of industrialization. So what you had was a kind of a very narrow core, which was concentrated next to the meeting of the Danube and the Sava River. And then a kind of a growing, sprawling unregulated city that was being populated by rural dwellers who were coming to seek their fortune in the city. Things really kind of didn't go anywhere in terms of trying to come up with a comprehensive master plan for Belgrade until the Second World War. And Belgrade was bombed several times during the war, both by the Allies and by the Germans. And it was left in ruins to a large extent. I can't remember the statistics, you have them in my book. But the city needed to be completely rebuilt. It wasn't just the buildings that were destroyed or damaged, but the infrastructure. So the tramways and the bridges and everything needed to be rebuilt. This in a context of, as with all the other East European states after the Second World War, a complete lack of resources. And that's really the challenge that that planners were faced with when they had to kind of imagine a new socialist Yugoslavia raising like a phoenix from these ashes.
Mm-hmm. So just for any of our listeners who aren't completely familiar with the communist takeover and how that came to be in Yugoslavia, although normally people listening to an East European podcast will know that, but because this is also architectural history, we may have listeners who aren't quite as familiar. Give us a little bit of the history of the immediate post-war Yugoslavia and this new government that has taken power, and what kind of new socialist Yugoslavia they're trying to build.
Yeah, so Yugoslavia was one of the few East European states that was really liberated by its own domestic partisan movement with the assistance of the Soviet Union, but not to the same extent as in the rest of Eastern Europe. And so that Yugoslavia was in a unique position in that sense, in that Tito and the partisans controlled Yugoslavia, not the Soviet Union. Tito derived a great deal of legitimacy from this. Much of the legitimacy of the communists at the end of the Second World War came from the fact that they had succeeded in liberating the country from the fascists, the Italian fascists, and the Nazi occupation, as well as groups like the Ustasha that had been given control over Croatia and Bosnia during the war. The other thing the other reason that this is important is because Tito, although he very much he endorsed the Soviet ideological and political and economic model, was a bit of a rogue actor. So he had a different idea of when to begin the process of revolution in Yugoslavia. In fact, he was more radical than Stalin was. He also had a different idea of Yugoslavia's regional role in relation to the Balkans. And all this came to a head in 1948 when the Soviet Union attempted to rein Yugoslavia in. And eventually expelled Yugoslavia from the common form. This was a very, very difficult position for Yugoslavia to be in. There was a kind of a panic that this would result in the communists loyal to Stalin overthrowing Tito. And Tito responded to this by purging the party of anyone that might have been suspected of sympathizing with the Inform Bureau. And so this also meant that Yugoslavia was cut off from the Eastern Bloc in terms of economic assistance and trade. And it meant that Yugoslavia was at risk of being invaded. What followed after this is, first of all, a gradual understanding that the Soviet Union was not going to invade and that Yugoslavia was going to be allowed to be you know, to evolve independently. And as well as a kind of a soul searching, right? Because if you get kicked out of the Eastern Bloc, you can't sort of affirm to abide by the same ideology and principles. There's sort of a logical problem there. And they developed a kind of alternative version of socialism called self-management, which they proclaimed to be superior to the so-called bureaucratic form of socialism that had been implemented in the in the Soviet Union. It was seen as being more authentic, more truly Marxist. And Yugoslavia began to craft a new image of itself as being kind of a more progressive socialist state, and one that could provide its citizens with a better standard of living, and one that was not allied with the Soviet Union, nor was it allied with the United States. So a kind of third way in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely talk about that history as we walk through the built environment in Belgrade. But it's good to have that overview of where Yugoslavia was and where it was starting to progress after World War II. So here they are. The war has ended. Tito and the partisans have taken control, and Belgrade is in ruins. And they now have to come up with a way to rebuild the city. And you emphasize that the rebuilding of Belgrade was strongly influenced by broader trends in architecture and urban planning, not just kind of internal ideas about what the city should look like. So can you explain the modernist concepts of architecture, and in particular the Athens Charter, for us?
Yeah. The period of industrialization in Europe had led to all kinds of problems with the city, you know, the traditional medieval city, and the city that had evolved in the early modern era wasn't really up to the challenges of the modern era. One of the biggest challenges being, in fact, the automobile. Right. Cities were not built for automobile traffic. There were also very serious problems with overcrowding and sort of hygiene in the sense of access to sunlight and clean air and clean running water and that sort of thing. In response to this, a growing number of architects who were modernist architects became preoccupied with trying to address these problems. And they began to come together informally, and then finally developed a group called the Congrès International d'Architecture Moderne, which people who speak English know as SIAM. And in 1933, they had a congress on this topic on a ship that sailed on the Mediterranean. And traveled to Athens, and they debated what should be done about the traditional city. And they came up with a number of very, very radical propositions about what needed to be done, which included, first of all, doing away completely with the traditional city. It couldn't be fixed. It just was not adapted to the machine age. And cities had to be built on a completely different model. So instead of having buildings that would be along the perimeter of a sidewalk around a city block, you should in fact kind of free buildings from those constraints and situate them freely and surround them with greenery, right? And so everyone would have access to sunlight. Everyone would have access to clean air. And you wouldn't end up with these this courtyard housing, which was quite common in Europe, you know, where housing filled in the insides of these courtyards and people living in there lived in very unhealthy living conditions. You could also harness the machine instead of sort of fighting the machine. You could harness the machine to build high rises efficiently, use a minimal footprint. and sort of industrialized construction so that housing would cost a lot less, and therefore you'd be able to provide good housing to everyone. There were also prescriptions relating to the separation of different kinds of traffic. There were all kinds of radical ideas about how cities should be changed. And Le Corbusier, who was one of the main participants in this Congress on the ship, took these ideas and wrote his own interpretation of them, which he published as the Athens Charter. And the Athens Charter was a kind of a manifesto, and it became a kind of a summary or a catchword referring to this notion of completely transforming the city so that it was adequate for the modern age, that it could provide a good standard of living to all the urban inhabitants, and that, you know, that this was a kind of a program that would be that would be championed and implemented by architects and urban planners around the world, not so much in the interwar period, but particularly after the Second World War, when in fact the devastation of the war seemed to provide an opportunity to start over.
Mm-hmm. And so that was certainly true in Belgrade. And so architects and planners such as Nikola Dobrović found the modernist concepts appealing not just because of the reasons you gave, but also because they felt like they fit in with this new socialist Yugoslavia. So can you talk more about that, about how the modernist was seen as being ideologically congruent with right. this new Yugoslavia?
So modernism per se was not, there was a conscious decision by the modernist movement to distance themselves from any ideological program. They wanted this to be something that any state could implement, that any authority could implement. There was definitely a sense that this a project on this scale would require the involvement of the state. But they, you know, in the kind of fraught conditions of the interwar period, the very politically divisive conditions, they decided to distance themselves from any politics. However, in Yugoslavia after the Second World War, in terms of the partisan state, the Titoist state's own objectives for how, you know, what kind of revolution it wanted to carry out in Yugoslavia, the Athens Charter fit in very neatly with this because, the main pillars of this were industrializing Yugoslavia on the Soviet model. So we're talking about heavy industry. So concentrating investment there, which meant that there were fewer resources available for improving the standard of living. So a kind of a program for rebuilding cities that emphasized how efficient it was and how, how it was going to resolve this this problem at minimal cost. That was obviously something that was that they were looking for. And Yugoslavia also had a promise of improving the lives of workers, right, the working class. And so the Athens Charter, again, promised to improve people's lives by building, you know, modern housing. And, of course, there's a whole modernization project around this of taking Yugoslavia from being essentially a state barely out of feudalism and taking it into the modern age, you know. And so there were just a lot of ways in which this program was very appealing to the socialist authorities. We have no idea whether, I mean, it seems actually quite unlikely, given Tito's taste, that he endorsed modernism as an aesthetic style. But you had, first of all, architects and planners who had supported the partisans during the war, and so they were obviously going to get priority in terms of having positions of authority after the war. And you have this program that seems to dovetail very nicely with the economic objectives of the state.
Mm-hmm. So even though, in a sense, they're starting with a clean slate in that Belgrade had been so destroyed during the war, they weren't actually rebuilding the city in a vacuum. So there's lots of challenges and obstacles and in many cases, the result of the war, as well as some of the things you've already described in terms of the political situation. So how did they go about actually trying to physically rebuild the city according to these principles?
Well, so at first, immediately after the war, there's kind of a focus on reconstruction. And that kind of, in many ways, went against the idea of a tabula rasa, in the sense that they're trying to salvage everything that they could. And because that in truth, was the least expensive way to deal with this crisis. So it's really only at the very tail end of the 1940s that they're talking about actually coming up with a master plan with the city. And interestingly, when they come up with the master plan, they tend to really kind of focus on big ideas. There's a utopian dimension to this. There's, you know, we're talking about a time of austerity where people have to believe that a better day is arriving, whether or not that was actually going to line up with the material possibilities of the time. And the easiest way to do that, in fact, was not to concentrate on the city that had been destroyed, but on a very large space right next to it across the Sava River, which was a kind of a wetland. It was a piece of land that was constantly being flooded, but that offered the possibility of building a new city center. And what they decided to do is to essentially dredge up a whole bunch of sand from the bottom of the river and pump it onto the banks of this piece of land in order to raise its height, in order to prevent it from being continuously flooded. And then they begin to build some key buildings on there. In particular, they build the Federal Executive Council, or they begin to build the Federal Executive Council and Hotel Yugoslavia, a hotel where delegates to the Federal Executive Council would be able to stay. And they build some other key infrastructure around there. They even begin to build a student accommodations. But all of this is unfortunately kind of, all of this grinds to a halt as a result of the Tito-Stalin split. But if you look in the master plan, you can see that there were really grand visions for what was going to go up on there. It was, again, very much determined by the ideas that Le Corbusier had set out in the Athens Charter, of being a very kind of scientific, rationally planned city with a grid pattern of different hierarchies of transportation, so main roads and then secondary roads. At the apex were going to be the sort of political buildings that of Federal Yugoslavia. So the symbolically most important location was taken up by these decision-making bodies. And then you were going to have various types of institutions located throughout this this map, as well as some housing. And it was, it was really designed to showcase the new urban planning ideas. And that is what the master plan really focused on, was sort of celebrating the building of a brand new city center to replace the destroyed and somewhat decadent and unrebuildable old city center.
Mm-hmm. And then, so after the split with Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union, the next master plan to be introduced was in 1950. And there was a really interesting statement by Miłosz Szymborski, who was head of the Town Planning Institute. And he said that you can understand how a society functions by looking at a land use map. So what did he mean by that? And how did this 1950 master plan show us how they were thinking that Belgrade would function and its society would function?
Well, I mean, one of the key ideas in the Athens Charter that I hadn't mentioned yet is this notion that a city is kind of like an organism. That it has different kinds of organs, if you like, and you have to sort of take care as to where you situate different functions of the city in order for the organism to function properly. And they identified, let's see if I can remember this, leisure, working, and living, and then there was transportation, were those four functions, if I got that right. And And the Athens Charter really kind of emphasized the notion that you shouldn't mix those different kinds of functions. You know, people should not, you know, in the 19th century city, people who worked in a factory might live right next to the factory and as a result, you know, have to deal with pollution and lack of sunlight and that sort of thing. So in the sort of ideal city, you know, you would have a particular part of the city that would be dedicated to residential uses, and it would be separate from industrial zones. And they would, in fact, be separated by a green, a buffer zone of greenery to sort of protect the residential zone from the industrial zone. So it was really this idea of organizing the city in such a way that that every function was separate and that the connections between the functions were rational, you know, that there were roads serving those connections and roads where automobiles and pedestrians, for example, would not be intersecting with one another.
Mm-hmm. And you already mentioned that after the split, Yugoslavia really began to use this language of self-management as what made their form of socialism unique and perhaps more pure. How did the architects and planners also deploy that language of self-management to support their visions of the modernist built environment?
Now you're asking me about a chapter I didn't have a chance to glance through again, so I'm going to have to try to reconstruct what it was that I was talking about. I think it really centered on the notion that self-management was about allowing the everyday worker to realize his full potential. And so there's a kind of refocusing on housing, right? A sense in which the parts of the Athens Charter that really emphasized the provision of high quality housing to workers takes on its full meaning, right? Whereas previously, for example, aspects of the Athens Charter aspects, in fact, not just of the Athens Charter, but of Le Corbusier's planning ideas in general that emphasized, you know, the efficient connections between the political decision-making bodies and the business center or the commercial center and you know, housing being, you know, built in a kind of logical fashion, you know, the kind of laying out of the city would have been the emphasis, say, in the master plan. Now they're focusing much more on the very specific issue of housing, right, and improving living conditions of the working men. So I think that that is one of the critical ways in which urban planners make a case for the continued relevance of their planning ideas.
Mm-hmm. And this emphasis on the standard of living and that you already mentioned and this emphasis on housing, tell us about the exhibit, A Dwelling for Our Conditions, and what we can learn from that exhibition about this kind of this focus on housing and better standard of living in the late 1950s in Yugoslavia.
Well, so that exhibit takes place in Ljubljana, and it kind of signals a shift in general in Yugoslavia towards an improvement in the standard of living. Which previously had sort of been played down in the interest of industrialization and in the aftermath of the Tito-Stalin split, also because a lot of money needed to be directed towards the defense budget, right? But now we're in the early 1950s. A new, more optimistic time is opening up, and Yugoslavia has decided to increase its investment in the standard of living and organizes a whole, you know, whole different kinds of ways of promoting new ideas about modern living. And this exhibition in Ljubljana is a good example of that. And there are some model apartments that are set up, model kitchens. There's an emphasis on home furnishings. And the emphasis is really on modern ideas about living, right? So we're talking about a society where, you know, the cities were growing largely because people were moving from the countryside from very traditional ways of living. And so there's a sense in which both urban dwellers who have been living in poor living conditions, and urban and rural dwellers who don't know how to live in a city can be brought into the modern age with these examples of how to live. And so, you know, we're talking about apartments that were fairly small. And so, you know, the big clunky furniture from the countryside is not going to work. And we're talking about, you know, modern kitchens with appliances. This is also the time when they bring in the first model supermarket from the United States and showcase convenience foods and frozen foods and try and introduce new ideas about how to cook, you know, not sort of foods that need to cook all day, but, you know, really what things that we associate with the 20th century in terms of the idea that both men and women would work and there would be limited time to prepare food. So, you know, this is really what's kind of highlighted, and as well as I would say an attempt to inject a little bit of glamour into people's lives. So, you know, there are pictures that appear about the exhibit in architecture magazines, and you can see that there's been an attempt to sort of project an idea of romance and of leisure into these images. The sense that maybe the husband and wife are about to enjoy a cocktail at the end of the day, right? And I think this speaks to the people's, you know, real thirst for you know, better times and a desire to, you know, enjoy everything that the post-war era at that moment seems to be offering them in terms of a better life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things that really struck me as was in the sense this almost perceived civilizing mission of the built environment, mm-hmm. that it was indeed about, you know, sort of efficiency and convenience of people and health, but also that this kind of raising people up who may have been peasants or workers to be able to live at live a better life, not just in terms of, you know, economically, but also kind of in how they think about life in themselves.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. That was really interesting. So we've been talking, go ahead.
I'll just throw in an anecdote that's kind of fun. I mean, when New Belgrade is beginning to be built, there are complaints of people, you know, sort of raising chickens in their, around the apartment buildings, of people hanging their laundry all over the place on the balconies, you know, just a generalized a kind of anxiety that these peasants are bringing their peasant ways to the city, right? And so mm-hmm. a sense that there's this very urgent need to teach people how you live in a city, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about the ideas behind the built environment, but what actually is being built and how are the people who are now starting to move into these spaces, whether they're leisure spaces or living spaces or workspaces, what are their responses? What do they think about this, these new physical buildings and physical environments?
So in the case of New Belgrade, there's a great deal of effort that's put into the design of the buildings. There are competitions for both the design of the blocks, the urban blocks in which the buildings are going to be built, and the buildings themselves. And so they're of a high architectural quality. In spite of the fact that, of course, one of the central ideas of the Athens Charter is to harness, you know, in industrial building techniques, harness the machine age to building more efficiently. Originally, at first, most of the buildings are built according to very traditional architectural or, you know, building construction techniques. Although over time, by the time we get into the late 1960s and 1970s, there, you know, we're starting to see prefabrication and, you know, design of modular building parts that can be assembled in different ways. So that, you know, that changes over time. But originally, we're talking about very traditional buildings techniques. But This represented a major improvement in people's standard of living. You know, a lot of the people who are being rehoused are people who lived in slum conditions, people who, you know, lived in homes made from recycled materials without running water. Suddenly they get to have an apartment with, you know, a kitchen and a bathroom and central heating. I mean, this is huge, huge for people. You get two kinds of populations moving in, people who are being rehoused, as well as people who are actually quite privileged in Yugoslavia. So people who work for state institutions, and particularly the army, and people who work for firms that make significant profits and therefore are able to invest in housing for their workers. And so you get this very kind of polarized population inhabiting, you know, a large part of the Yugoslav working class is left out of this project simply because the companies that they work for don't turn enough of a profit to be able to offer significant amounts of housing. And what housing they do have, they tend to give to skilled workers that they want to keep.
Yeah, so this is, it seems like it's working. And yet by 1964, there was kind of a backlash against these housing blocks, and that there started to be complaints about building these big, you know, kind of high rise tower apartment blocks. So what was the problem? What now by the early 60s, this turn against this structure of housing?
So there's a number of things that are happening. Places like New Belgrade were never perfect. They were always beset by some challenge or another. So in the early period, it was the fact that there was so little housing that was built that oftentimes more than one family was being forced to share to a single apartment together. So that was completely subverting the very idea of teaching people how to live a cultured life and improving their standard of living, right? When families have to share a bathroom, or, you know, there's one family that whose space that they've been assigned to is the bathroom, right? And then later, the problem is going to be that there's such an emphasis on building housing that the construction of housing happens at a much faster pace than anything else. So schools, any kind of shopping, post office, anything, health, you know, health clinics. You know, New Belgrade is a desert in that sense. It's in fact, people start referring to it as a kind of a dormitory city, a place where you go to sleep. There's nothing else to do there. There are also complaints about the quality of the workmanship. So windows falling out, you know, Bill sometimes complains also about buildings being poorly designed with, say, a pillar running through your living room. So there are always challenges in New Belgrade. But the interesting thing is that in the 1960s, you begin to get challenges that are different, challenges that get at the very idea of the kind of neighborhoods that were being created, right? Not simply complaints about how housing was being distributed or the quality of the housing, but the idea that the very urban planning model was flawed. Some of that actually comes from planners and architects themselves who have had a chance to build these settlements for a while now and are looking at them and they're finding them wanting. You know, they're looking at them and then they look at old neighborhoods and they say, Why is there nowhere here for people to gather? Or, you know, we've actually designed places for people to gather, but they don't gather in them. Why? Why is that? What's wrong? Why do these places seem boring? Why do we not get a sense of community here? And they kind of, you know, really focus their discussion on the idea of what they call ambient, or the idea of a kind of maybe an ambiance, a kind of quality of personality and positive community spirit that is lacking. And they, you know, they talk about how you might change designs in order to foster that kind of thing. But at the same time, as they're trying to reconsider and maybe reinvent these kinds of settlements. The press and a number of social scientists are launching vitriolic attacks on these settlements, calling them places that foster delinquency, claiming that living in high rises actually is bad for your health, talking about, in general, the idea that no one should live in these settlements, that they're flawed, and that we need to get rid of this kind of urban planning concept and this kind of housing. Mm-hmm.
You talk a lot about the rise of social scientists as a powerful force around urban planning in the 1960s. What caused that? What brought that about?
I think that this is not just in Yugoslavia. I think this is a global phenomenon. And part of it is actually rooted in the evolution of urban planning as a discipline, a sense that it wasn't something that was merely technical and therefore that architects could do, but that urban planning was also about understanding how societies function. And therefore, you had to bring economists and sociologists and various other kinds of social scientists into the conversation about how they should be designed. And I think, at this time, again, globally, there is a deep anxiety about society sort of fragmenting, a sense of a lack of cohesion or a kind of, how to explain it, that the bonds between people are disintegrating, right? And of course, sociologists in Yugoslavia are reading sociology being produced in the United States and being produced in Europe. And so they're kind of attuned to these kinds of anxieties and applying it in their own context. And of course, Yugoslavia, since the Second World War, has been undergoing profound transformations, right? And so a sense that society is changing and that the bonds between people are being dissolved or are not in place, that is very much something that you can see reflected in Yugoslav society. And like in the rest of the world, there is a very easy scapegoat for all of this. And that is if these neighborhoods are dysfunctional, it must be because of the buildings, right? This is the kind of critique that is also being leveled in France, in Germany, in the UK, and in various other places.
Mm-hmm. One of the responses to the need for housing, but also the growing expectation for higher standards of living is what you call rogue construction. So who were these rogue people and what were they constructing?
Right. So the majority of people involved in rogue construction are people who come to Belgrade to work. And most of them, I would say, work either in transportation or in the construction sector. These are unskilled workers working in economic sectors that are not highly profitable, and as a result, they're unable to secure housing through the regular channels. And there, because there's a lot of these people in Belgrade, all of the housing that's available privately, spare rooms, basements, all of it is going at exorbitant prices. And so a lot of people decide to deal with this simply by finding a piece of land somewhere on the periphery of the city and just building a house. And it sort of appears in the beginning of the 60s and starts to take on epidemic proportions. It becomes such a big issue that the city council returns to it time after time, trying to figure out how to deal with this problem. And it's problematic for a number of reasons. First of all, because it reproduces these kind of low quality living conditions that the city is trying to do away with in the first place. People are also building on sites that have been determined to have been assigned to build, big buildings, and suddenly they can't do it because people have built a shack. In general, there's a sense that that this is symptomatic of the kind of the failure of the housing provision system, right? And that something needs to be done about it. And so the question is, you know, what can we do? We clearly aren't building fast enough, and we aren't building cheaply enough that we can provide these people with housing. So what do we do about it? You know, these people seem to be really good at fixing their own problem. And so the municipal authorities end up devising the solution. Well, why don't we allow them to build their housing, but designate parcels that are appropriate for that and have oversight over the construction so that it meets minimal standards, right? Alongside this kind of this emerging crisis and the emerging solution to the crisis, there is a growing sense that maybe people are building houses not just because they have to, but because they want to live in a house, right? And shouldn't we allow people the opportunity to live in the kind of housing that they want? And this argument becomes particularly potent because of market reforms that happened in the mid-1960s that are trying to make the construction sector more efficient by really stimulating competition, right? By essentially directing that housing construction will no longer just be financed through the mechanism of workers setting aside a part of their income and then their firm essentially buying buildings and then distributing it to workers, but that they want firms, in fact, to compete with one another for business. Firms will continue buying from them, but so can individuals buy their own apartments, right? And there's this whole notion of trying to stimulate consumption of housing in order to make the housing sector more efficient. And therefore, if what people want is single family homes, then shouldn't we try to accommodate that, right? And so this is definitely a major challenge to the urban planning model that they had adopted until that point, which privileged this kind of high density, high rise construction over this kind of American model of urban sprawl, you know, of single family housing with each house having its own yard and that sort of thing.
And indeed, in 1966, the Belgrade municipal officials hired Wayne State University to complete a land use transportation study as the basis for a new master plan. So why did they turn to the United States? Why use these American planners to assist them in this new planning process? And what was the new, the new vision that came out of this?
Yeah. And one of the things that I should say is that urban planners were kind of opposed to this this notion of catering to people's wish for single family homes, right? Based on the notion that Yugoslavia's material possibilities, you know, the wealth of the country could not actually support single family housing, that people could not actually afford single family housing. It's not that they actually come to emulate the American model. If anything, this is a trend again that goes beyond Yugoslavia, a sense that that the United States was really at the forefront of the crisis of the modern city, right? That due to the growth of automobile usage and urban sprawl that resulted from that the Americans were way ahead of everyone else in having these problems, and therefore that they were way ahead of everyone else in trying to find solutions for these problems. Urban planners in Yugoslavia by the mid-1960s are really kind of facing a bit of a crisis of legitimacy. This urban planning model that they'd been promoting for a while had been somewhat successful, but was increasingly being challenged by social scientists, by popular demand for single-family housing, by municipal authorities' willingness to sort of cave in to, you know, this rogue construction pressure. And they needed to find a way to kind of reassert their legitimacy. And so when it comes time to do a new master plan, they are wanting to sort of, adopt the most contemporary, the most cutting edge methodologies and technologies in order to deal with Belgrade's problems, which, by the way, go beyond this housing issue to, for example, automobile usage explodes in Yugoslavia as well. And so they have problems with transportation. And Wayne State University in Detroit is at the forefront of sort of testing out new computer modeling technologies in developing land use models. That's why ultimately they turn to Wayne State University. They hire several consultants from the university to train them how to use these computers, computers from the late 1960s, which take up an entire room and use these cards, right? They hire these people to teach them how to use this technology in order to develop a new master plan. And the idea, which is very different than the idea that that they were working with in the 1950s. In the 1950s, it was really what I call blueprint planning, the idea that they could imagine the city that they wanted and put it into practice. By the 1970s, they don't believe that anymore. Now they believe that the only thing that they can do is attempt to shape existing trends, you know, that they can manage the pressures that are acting on the city. And that's why computer modeling is well suited to this, because the idea is to try and input all this information about all the trends that were taking place in the city and get a sense of how different decisions would lead to different outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, you talk about the relationship between modernism as a particular point of view or way of approaching the built environment and modernization. And so what do you think we can learn from this case study of Belgrade about post-war Europe, about urban planning, about these visions for how societies should be shaped?
That's a big question.
Yes.
Well, the key lesson for me as regards the relationship between modernism and modernization was that modernism was a very specific modernization project, right? And that it had its heyday in Yugoslavia precisely because it was in line with ideas about modernization, about what it meant to modernize Yugoslavia. That modernizing Yugoslavia was about, you know, investing resources as efficiently as possible. It was about using scientific methodologies or supposedly scientific methodologies, that it was about bringing in, it was sort of bringing the society in line with the machine age, that it was about improving standards of living, right? So there's an egalitarian project there. At the moment in time when these objectives made sense, modernism was a really potent concept that really found its place in Yugoslav society. But it kind of sowed the seeds of its own destruction, because as society in Yugoslavia did modernize according to this program, people's aspirations changed, right? The notion that the state would play this kind of overarching role in providing for people and in directing society fell to the side in favor of this notion that people should be, the idea of the consumer making choices, became much more powerful. And so, by the late 1960s, the modernist moment had passed in Yugoslavia. And, you know, it kind of coincided also with the sort of the increasing, you know, centripetal forces that were pulling Yugoslavia apart at the time. And so it's hard to say, you know, what followed, because what followed was really the beginning of the end of Yugoslavia.
Wow. And that's a good point to end our conversation about this book, which I, again, found really fascinating, and looking at all of these post-war social, economic, ideological aspects of Yugoslavia through the built environment. So thank you for that. And thank you for having this conversation with me today and about the book. And I'd like to close by asking what you're working on now.
Well, I'm working on two projects. One of the projects actually spun out a little bit of this first project, and it's on migrant workers from Yugoslavia in Western Europe during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And the connection there is that when some of this road construction that was taking place, when I asked about it, people would say, "Oh, that was a Gastarbeiter, a migrant worker from Germany who built that house." And so I became really intrigued about these people who were working in Western Europe, but clearly continued to feel as Yugoslav citizens because they came home and invested their money in building a house in Yugoslavia. And so I'm sort of investigating the nature of that relationship between those workers living abroad for very long periods of time and Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia as an idea, Yugoslavia as a place, and Yugoslavia as a state. Okay. And my second project, so the labor migrant project I'm wrapping up at the moment, and my second project I've recently begun deals with another city, the city of Rijeka, which had been a Habsburg city, the main port of the Hungarian part of the Habsburg Empire, in fact, and in 1924 becomes part of Italy, and then after the Second World War becomes part of Yugoslavia. And I'm interested in how this border change after the Second World War impacted the city of Rijeka. In particular, I'm interested in the notion of, you know, how borders what impact borders have on reconfiguring cities as a result of their re-embedding in different networks, right? New and different networks, trade networks, transportation networks, you know, new flows of people, of goods, of ideas. And so in tandem with that, I'm also working on an interactive historical map, which is internet-based and crowdsourced, and onto which people can input their memories of the city of Rijeka at various moments in time. So sort of venturing into the digital humanities and, you know, what does it mean to crowdsource history and historical knowledge?
Wow, that's a really exciting project. And I look forward to having the chance to see that, both the scholarly work, but also this crowdsource interactive map. And hopefully in the future, we will have a chance to talk to you about one or both of those projects on the New Books Network podcast series. But again, thank you very much for your time today. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this book.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.